Iowa's giving the Democrats fits. It ain't over till it's over with Barra and Osi. And hair today, gone tomorrow. We remember the late James Traficant. From WAMU 88.5 in Washington, I'm Ken Rudin, and this is The Political Junkie.
You like Ike, I like Ike, everybody likes Ike.
For president.
Add Ike to you, add Ike to me, I don't care how you quote it.
Come on and vote for Kennedy, vote for Kennedy, and we'll come out on top.
Vote for Richard Nixon and Henry Cabot Lodge, cause they're the ones to lead the USA.
Thanks for joining us, and welcome to episode 45 of The Political Junkie. We're just over a month away from the November midterms. Everyone's been spending so much time focusing on how Kansas may be slipping away from the Republicans that we're only now realizing that Iowa may be moving away from the Democrats. They've held the seat for 30 years. We'll check in on the battle to succeed the retiring Tom Harkin. A big debate is coming up next week in Sacramento between a freshman Democratic congressman and a former Republican incumbent. We'll talk about the local and national implications of the race in California's 7th Congressional District. Also, we look back to a 1993 key congressional retirement announcement, one that helped move House Republicans into a more ideological and confrontational position. And we say goodbye to James Traficant, who charmed and amused everyone who watched him on C-SPAN, and who embarrassed and shamed his beleaguered city of Youngstown. But first, the trivia question. Back to that Sacramento congressional race. It involves incumbent Democrat Ami Barra, who is seeking a second term. Barra was born in Los Angeles to parents from India, but who was the last member of Congress to be born in India? Send your answer to trivia at krpoliticaljunkie.com. We'll pick a winner at random from the bunch. The winner will get a fabulous vintage Political Junkie button. Again, that's trivia at krpoliticaljunkie.com. And there's no need to ever wait again for the weekly trivia question. Hop over to the Political Junkie page on Facebook. We post a trivia question for fans only every Wednesday. And there's other great stuff on the page, too. That's the Political Junkie on Facebook. We're the one with the button. We'll give you the answer to last week's trivia question later in the show, so stick around. From the outset, every junkie thought control of the Senate would rest on vulnerable Democrats from states that went for Mitt Romney in 2012. If the Republicans were going to reach a majority, they had to win in places like Alaska and Louisiana and Arkansas, states where Obama is very unpopular. We've always talked about how these plans never included a state like Kansas, which had always been a GOP gimme until recently. And we didn't include a state like Iowa either, which has sent Democrat Tom Harkin to the Senate five times. But a poll put out this week by the Des Moines Register shows the Republican Senate nominee, Joni Ernst, with a 6-point lead over Democratic Congressman Bruce Braley. Those numbers send shivers down Democrats' spines. Kathy Obradovich is a political columnist at the Des Moines Register and is here to tell us how the calculus has shifted. Kathy, welcome to the Political Junkie.
Thanks for having me, Ken.
The Senate race was always supposed to be close, but the conventional wisdom, I thought, was always that Braley, the Democrat, was in the lead. Has that changed, and if so, why?
It has changed, Ken. And when we talk about Bruce Braley being in the lead, he was the first Democrat to hold up his hand after Tom Harkin said he was going to retire, and no other Democrats joined the primary. So he, sitting congressman, no primary opponent, all he had to do from January of 2013 until June of 2014 was raise money as fast as he could, and that is what he did. Joni Ernst, meanwhile, the Republican nominee, had a 6-way primary, and a lot of the talk during the primary season was that perhaps nobody would even win that primary outright, and that they would have to choose their nominee by convention. That actually happened in Iowa's 3rd Congressional District this year. So we thought, a lot of people thought, I thought, the Republicans had a chance of coming out of that nomination battle weakened with a candidate that the party didn't agree on and who had no money at all. And that is not what happened. Joni Ernst came out of the primary strong. She won it decisively and immediately started to weaken Bruce Braley by defining him to general election voters before he could define himself.
We always hear that Republicans have this huge gender gap, but if anything, the gender gap is hurting the Democrats in this race. I looked at your poll, the Des Moines Register poll. Women support Braley, the Democrat, by 13 points, 46 to 33, but men support Ernst, the Republican, by 25 points, 55-30.
Yeah, isn't that interesting?
Yeah, why do you think that is?
A couple things. One of the places where Joni Ernst is really shining in Iowa is in rural Iowa. She's got a 4-1 lead over Braley in rural Iowa. She had, during the primary in particular, come out for gun rights, so a Second Amendment supporter against gun control. She came out very strong as conservative, so against abortion rights. She came out very strong as a promoting her background as a soldier. She was she served in the and still does serve in the Iowa National Guard and served in the Middle East. So she has hit a lot of points that I think could appeal to male voters. And then, not to mention, she started her primary season with an ad that really just blew the lid off, where she talked about her background on an Iowa farm castrating hogs. And I think that earthy twist and the play on words that she's going to go to Washington and cut pork absolutely appealed to men.
Speaking of gender, Iowa has never, as you know, and you've been probably reminded a million times, Iowa has never, ever sent a woman to the U.S. Senate or the House. Does that come up in the Senate race discussion?
It has. It's not being brought up very much by Joni Ernst, however. It is a big part of the discussion in Iowa. There are two women running for Congress, one Republican and one Democrat, and Joni Ernst is a Republican running for Senate. So Iowa has three opportunities now to break that glass ceiling. And it absolutely is part of the discussion. That may be one reason also why Bruce Braley is not leading as decisively with women as Democrats might normally expect to.
What are the strengths and weaknesses of each candidate? Let's start with Braley. I mean, I saw a lot of things that he missed a bunch of Veterans Committee hearings, and that seemed to have struck a chord.
Yeah, so the Register's poll last weekend looked at some of the claims that being made in ads against each candidate, and that one that you just mentioned, Bruce Braley missing Veterans Administration Committee hearings in the past year, definitely bothered voters. In fact, a big majority of voters said that was a problem for him, including some of his supporters. Joni Ernst has been a little bit hesitant to take a firm stand on what she would do with Social Security. Voters saw her discussion of privatization of Social Security as an option as a problem for her. But I don't think the candidate's biggest problems are really based on issues. When I said before that Joni Ernst had helped define Bruce Braley for voters, Republicans did that with an ad that showed Bruce Braley talking to trial lawyers at a private fundraiser and disparaging Chuck Grassley.
If you help me win this race, you may have someone with your background, your experience, your voice, someone who's been literally fighting tort reform for 30 years in a visible and public way on the Senate Judiciary Committee, or you might have a farmer from Iowa who never went to law school, never practiced law, serving as the next chair of the Senate Judiciary Committee. Because if Democrats lose the majority, Chuck Grassley will be the next chair of the Senate Judiciary Committee.
That was huge in Iowa. Republican Senator Chuck Grassley is the most popular politician in the state, bar none, and also came across as disparaging farmers. So that's a big negative for him.
What's so remarkable about that tape is that if you listen to, and you were there, you were one of the moderators of the debate, but last Sunday's debate, Bruce Braley spent a lot of time talking about that he was bipartisan, that he would reach across party lines, that he would consult with Chuck Grassley.
All right, Mr. Braley,
yes.
If you are elected to the Senate, who is the first person you would call for advice?
Chuck Grassley.
Okay.
All right.
And Ms. Ernst? Grassley.
What's so mind-boggling about that is, one, Tom Harkin, the retiring Democratic senator, was sitting in the audience.
Exactly. And that I think, was the most striking thing about it. The other part, of course, is I think it was Bruce Braley reminding people that he still holds Chuck Grassley in high regard, regardless of what he had said about him before, trying to make the point that he still holds Chuck Grassley in high regard. Tom Harkin sitting in the audience must have thought, what?
The other thing in the debate that struck me, and this also came towards the end, and it's a long cut. I want you to hear the tape. I want to play the tape. It's a long cut, but this is just very bizarre to me. Let's just listen to this piece of tape towards the end.
And this is to Mr. Braley. Why do you and the Democratic Party think you're better qualified to make decisions for me and other Iowans, such as taking over health care?
Well, I think it's because I'm a bridge builder, not a bridge burner. I have a proven track record of working with Republicans. The very first bill I introduced created a job training act in biofuels through Iowa community colleges. I got that passed in the farm bill by working with a Republican from Alabama. I worked with Republicans from Minnesota to get benefits for the Iowa National Guard that were being denied them by the Pentagon. I worked with a Republican from Georgia to keep Iowa manufacturing jobs here instead of having them go overseas. And I have a proven history of working across the aisle with Republicans in the House and the Senate, because that's what Iowans deserve from their next senator. Senator Ernst would have voted to shut down the federal government with Ted Cruz. She's called President Obama a dictator and thinks impeachment should be on the table.
I would like to respond to that. Congressman, you threatened to sue a neighbor over chickens that came onto your property. You're talking about bipartisanship. How do we expect as Iowans to believe that you will work across the aisle when you can't walk across your yard?
That's just not true.
10 seconds. Gotta go.
It's just not true. I never threatened to sue anyone. It's not true.
That was so bizarre.
So the background of that is that Bruce Braley and his wife have a vacation home, and there was a dispute, I think, involving the Neighborhood Association over these chickens. And a letter was written that suggested, I think you would have to read between the lines, that would suggest that this was going to end up in court if it wasn't resolved. And so that issue has been something that Republicans have brought up as sort of part of the theme of Bruce Braley doesn't respect farmers. It was an odd moment in the debate, and it's one that clearly Bruce Braley wasn't expecting. His response, that's just not true. But that's all he had to say about it, and it came at the very end of the debate, so there wasn't much time to get into it.
I also want to play some tape about the way Braley described his opponent in Sunday's debate. Let's listen.
This election is about a clear choice between moving Iowa forward or following a radical Tea Party agenda that's going to take us backwards. And on issue after issue, Senator Ernst has stood with the Koch brothers in their extreme agenda that's wrong for Iowa, from repealing the federal minimum wage to privatizing Social Security to opposing the Farm Bill and the renewable fuel standard.
And this is how Ernst saw her opponent.
I believe Washington is taking our country in the wrong direction. And for the past 8 years, Congressman Braley has been there, voting with Nancy Pelosi. Higher taxes, bigger government, the Wall Street bailout, Obamacare. This is his Washington record. He can't defend it, so he's running the most negative campaign that Iowans have ever seen. Washington has failed, but I believe in the Iowa way, because I believe that Iowans know what's best for Iowa more than politicians in Washington, D.C.
These are two candidates that are not especially fond of each other.
No, they're not. And what you heard from Joni Ernst at the end, the Iowa way versus Washington, D.C., is something that you are hearing a lot from Republicans in the State House, and actually Democrats in the State House as well, because Iowa's split legislature, Iowa's a purple state, so Republican House, Democratic Senate, split legislature actually last year did a lot of pretty weighty legislation, tax reform, et cetera, working together. And a lot of what they like to do here is say, you know, Iowa can work with divided government, but Washington, D.C. can't. That's a pretty savvy sort of outsider argument that Joni Ernst is making there.
And nobody could really be truly bipartisan if he attacks chickens, right?
Yeah, well, so I said early on in this race that we needed to get it out of the barnyard between the hog castration and the chickens, you know, and for some reason candidates keep coming back to that.
Sounds like utter chaos.
Hey,
sorry.
Oh, moo.
I know. Kathy Obradovich is a political columnist for the Des Moines Register. She's on Twitter at K Obradovich, Obradovich. Kathy, thanks so much for being on the show.
Thanks, Ken.
There's another debate of note coming up next week in Sacramento. In California's 7th Congressional District, freshman Democrat Ami Bera will square off against Doug Osi. Osi is a Republican who held a different House seat from 1999 through 2004. Bera narrowly defeated GOP Congressman Dan Lundgren 2 years ago. But the political climate looks much better this year for the Republicans, and Osi has come out of retirement to seek the seat. We thought we'd take a look at the national implications of the race with Dave Wasserman, the House editor for the Cook Political Report. Dave, welcome to the Political Junkie.
Thanks very much, Ken.
And on the ground in California, Chris Catalago has been following this race for the Sacramento Bee. Chris, thanks for joining us.
Good to be here.
Chris, describe California's 7th District for me. I know it's the Sacramento suburbs. It looks to be pretty evenly divided politically.
Yeah, politically, Democrats hold about a 2 percentage point registration advantage. The district takes in much of suburban Sacramento. Much of this area was represented previously by Republican Congressman Dan Lundgren, who you may remember represented Southern California in Congress in the 1980s.
Dave, when we're looking at national implications for congressional seats, we're looking at, of course, districts that President Obama carried 2 years ago that might not be as favorable to the Democrats this time around. Has the president become an issue in this race?
Well, he has. And in a district as evenly divided as this one, you can bet that President Obama's approval rating right now is well under where he was in his share of the vote. And in most polling that we're seeing of the district, Obama's approval rating in California's 7th is in the low 40s. So he is a drag, even in some districts that he did carry in 2012. For perspective, President Obama actually lost the majority of congressional districts in 2012 to Mitt Romney. And so the fact that the House battleground, which is fairly small, only about 36 seats in our estimation, is playing out in districts that Obama won is really bad news for Democrats. It means that Republicans are probably going to pick up in the high single-digit range of seats this fall. And if they manage to pick up 13 seats, which would be about their absolute max, they would have their largest majority since Herbert Hoover was elected president in 1928.
What interests me about this is that in many districts around the country, Democrats will move to the left to embolden their and excite their base. Republicans will move to the right. But both candidates, Bera and Osi, seem to be pretty much running up the middle. Osi's a moderate Republican. He was a moderate Republican when he was in the House. Bera's talking about political nonpartisan solutions. Both candidates seem to be running as centrist candidates.
You know, what's most interesting about this race is that in 2012, Ami Bera was running as a doctor, as a non-politician, running against a career politician in Dan Lundgren, someone who had moved from Southern California and actually represented Southern California in the House to the Sacramento area seat. And now, even though Ami Bera is the incumbent in this race, he is employing some of the same strategy, trying to portray Doug Osi, a former congressman, as tied in with Washington Republican insider cronies, and still continuing to try and portray himself as an outsider in the House, someone who isn't beholden to the establishment of either party, and embracing the mantra of an organization called No Labels, which has tried to foster bipartisan cooperation. So very unique circumstances in a race between an incumbent and a challenger.
Well, first of all, in the June primary, when all the candidates ran on the same ballot, Bera got 48% of the vote and Osi got 26%. One, does that tell us anything about what's going to happen next month? And two, the conservative Republicans who also were on the ballot, who were opposed to Osi's so-called moderation, have they rallied behind Osi's candidacy?
I would argue that the primary actually helped Doug Osi a great deal, and here's why. he was framed within essentially a three-way race, because in California we have a top two primary and all candidates run on the same ballot. He was framed by a Democrat on one side, an Ami Bera, and a Tea Party Republican, an Igor Berman, on the other. And so to a lot of voters, he came across as the moderate choice, and that's helpful in a general election setting. I think OC's reputation as one of the more moderate former members on the Republican side does help him in this setting.
Dave, if you're looking at outside money, national outside money, is a lot of outside money coming into this race?
There is a decent amount of outside money coming into this race. And at the same time, the big question mark has been how much money Doug Ose is personally willing to invest in this race. It's amazing that Ose has raised as much money as he has and has gotten as much outside support from Republican groups as he has, considering the fact that he is independently wealthy. And many donors might simply assume that Ose should spend his own money to win this seat. And we are seeing groups get involved.
Chris, is there a lot of indication that the race is pretty active on the TV screen, a lot of commercials?
Certainly, there's a lot of commercials. I think we see over $2 million just at this point alone spent since the primary on both these candidates, about $1 million to oppose Bera and another $1 million to support him. A lot of that is from the national Democratic groups, House Majority PAC, DCCC. On the OC side, about an equal amount, about $1 million to oppose Bera, but to David's point, we've only seen about 100,000 coming in from outside groups to support OC, and I think that's where you're starting to see a bit of an area where he might have to make some of that up, whether it's with the money he raised. I know at the last reporting period, we had about 200,000, 250,000 in the bank. This next reporting period, it will be very interesting to see how much he may have contributed to his campaign to get his own message out.
Chris, topping the ballot is the race for governor. Jerry Brown has a huge lead over his Republican rival. Does it have the possibility of affecting races down the ballot?
I think folks are looking at this race as a race unto itself. I don't think anyone will tell you on either campaign that they're relying on anybody at the top of the ticket to help boost turnout, drive turnout here. A lot of the ballot measures that we have here in California involve sort of select battles among special interest groups. We don't have a same-sex marriage one or a medical marijuana one or one that might sort of help drive a broader base of turnout.
There's a month or so to go before the election. How do you both see the race? Dave, let's start with you.
It's a pure toss-up at this point. If you forced me to guess, I would probably say OC. But it would be a pure hunch on my part. As far as the governor's race goes, I don't think there's any doubt that Jerry Brown will win statewide, but I don't think he'll be winning the kinds of margins, particularly outside of urban California, that Obama was winning in 2012. In fact, I think he could fall short in some of these more marginal districts, and that could actually be a slight drag on Democratic performance across the board. I think Bera has been very successful in carving out an identity that's unique from Nancy Pelosi and the larger Democratic Party. But considering the mix of voters that's likely to turn out in a midterm and the fact that he only beat a flawed incumbent in 2012 by about 5,700 votes, as Chris alluded to, it shouldn't be that heavy a lift for Republicans to get this district back.
I think we're looking at this as David said, a pure toss-up, and you know, we're still sort of holding out to see whether things shift one way or another. But right now, it'd be very tough to call. And I think OC is relying potentially on a depressed turnout to help him get over the hump. The question will be, does it fall so low that Bera still has a large enough contingent of Democrats who, no matter what, will turn out that could put him over the top? And I think that'll be one to watch for is we know turnout will be low, but will it be so low that it may end up kind of coming back to haunt some Republicans.
Dave Wasserman is the House expert at the Cook Political Report. His Twitter handle is @redistrict. Dave, it was great having you on the show.
Hey, thanks very much, Ken.
And Chris Catalago is a political reporter for the Sacramento Bee. You can find him on Twitter at @CCatalago, CADELAGO. Chris, thanks so much.
Thanks a lot.
And just so you know, I'm on Twitter too, at Ken Rudin. And I'm going to be in Sacramento next week for events with Capital Public Radio. And I'm going to be with Beth Boryak, the host of Capital Public Radio's Insight program, watching and analyzing the Barra-Ossi debate on Wednesday evening. Check out our website, krpoliticaljunkie.com, for more information. It's time to reveal the answer and winner of last week's trivia question, which was, if Pat Roberts loses his re-election bid next month in Kansas, the Republican Senate winning streak there that goes all the way back to 1936 will come to an end. Which state or states would then hold the longest GOP Senate winning streak? And the answer is Wyoming and Utah. Neither has elected a Democrat to the Senate since 1970. Ben Amrami of Los Angeles knew that. He's this week's randomly selected winner. And he gets the coveted political junkie button. And you might remember some guy named Neil Conan hosting last week. He played you this special trivia question.
Hi, Ken. This is John Woltman in Milwaukee, Oregon. I'd like to know if there have been any married couples in Congress, either the House or the Senate, who have come from different states. If I can borrow your phrase, as you well know, the last example of this was Nancy Kalsenbaum, the senator from Kansas, and Howard Baker, the Republican senator from Tennessee, who later went on to become chief of staff to Ronald Reagan.
John, that was a great question, and we'll get to it in 1 second, but just one little correction here. Howard Baker and Nancy Kalsenbaum were married, but after they both left the Senate, so that doesn't really apply. But you do have a good question. Members of Congress who were married from different states while serving in Congress. Anyway, that question did not stump our listeners for too long. Here's our first correct answer.
Hello, this is David Gross from Silver Spring, Maryland. The person with this was from Kansas, so perhaps might be interested in knowing that Martha Keith was married to Andy Jacobs, a representative from Indiana.
David is correct. It's Martha Keys of Kansas and Andy Jacobs of Indiana. Who else?
This is Elliot Kivell, and I am calling from Congressional District 13 in the state of New York. And as you well know, Ken, Connie Mack of Florida was married to Mary Bono Mack of California, and they both lost their re-election battle at the same time.
Actually, Connie Mack lost his bid for the Senate in 2012. Mary Bono Mack defeated for re-election in her bid for Congress, but yes, they both left Congress at the same time. For the record, they got divorced last year. I wonder if her attorney took the case pro bono. Anyway, congratulations to David and Elliot for winning this week's special trivia question. And those of you sore losers have another chance. Here's our next call-in trivia question.
Hi, Ken. My name is Dmitry Kalmakov. I am from New York City, from Queens. And I am calling to ask a question. And the question is, are there any Russian-American lawmakers or anyone currently serving in office, or if there ever were any in the past? I am very curious. I happen to be a Russian American myself who is a political junkie. I wish to run for office one day. I would love to know the answer to that question. So thank you so much and have a wonderful day. Bye-bye.
I like that question. Okay, so we're looking for Russian-born office holders. Comrades, call into our Political Junkie voicemail. Our number is 316-KEN-9646. That's 316-936-9646. We'll play your answers on next week's show, da? And there are more questions to come. And you can even contribute your own. If you missed that number, go to krpoliticaljunkie.com. Neil Conan and I were out gallivanting at the Political Junkie Roadshow last weekend in Rochester, New York, so there wasn't a new scuttle button puzzle. Sometimes we decide that it's good to rest your brain cells now and then. But there will be a new scuttle button puzzle this week. Be sure to check that out on our website. Did you forget already? It's krpoliticaljunkie.com. It's time for This Week in Political History. One of the most revered and respected members of the House by both parties was Bob Michael of Illinois. A Republican from Peoria, he was elected to Congress in 1956, rose to become House Minority Leader, and retired after 1994. Just as he was saying goodbye, the Republican Party was about to end a 40-year drought and claim the majority. It's pretty hard in these days of uber partisanship to imagine a member of Congress as beloved on both sides of the aisle. But that's the kind of guy Bob Michael was and is. It was during this week, October 4th, 1993, that Michael announced he would not seek another term. When Michael retired, his party chose Newt Gingrich of Georgia as the top Republican in the House. When they won the majority in 1994, Gingrich became Speaker and charted a different course for the GOP. Ray LaHood, Michael's longtime chief of staff, was elected to succeed his boss in Congress. He would go on to serve 14 years in the House, where he became a leading advocate for civility and bipartisanship. After he retired in 2009, he was picked by President Obama as Secretary of Transportation. Ray LaHood joins us now to talk about his longtime friend, Bob Michael, what he meant to the institution, and how things have changed since he left. Congressman, or Mr. Secretary, or Ray LaHood, welcome to the Political Junkie.
Thank you, Ken.
Anyone who's a student of current politics might find it astounding to see a leader of a party in the House so well-liked, but that was Bob Michael.
Well, there's no question. Over a 38-year career, Bob made a lot of friends. He used the legislative process to solve problems, to move the country forward. He did it in a way that distinguished the job that he had, not only as the longest-serving leader, 14 years, but as one of the longest-serving congressmen, 38 years. I think people tend to forget that all of Ronald Reagan's 8 years as president, Bob Michael was the leader and the Democrats were in control, and Bob helped President Reagan push through his legislative agenda in a way that I think people have forgotten a little bit about around Washington in a bipartisan way.
Well, here's another example of the bipartisanship you talk about. At the end of the 103rd Congress, as Michael was retiring, and as Speaker Tom Foley, who was defeated that year, was also leaving, here's what the man from Peoria had to say.
You came to the Speaker's office at a time when our institution needed the kind of virtues you have for so long typified. Integrity, decency, and a commitment to crafting reasoned solutions to difficult problems. You've always had what I like to think of as the primary virtue of the legislator. The ability to combine personal integrity, party loyalty, and parliamentary skills for the good of the nation.
Ray, can you imagine a situation today in which the leader of one party would so honor the leader of another party on the House floor?
Well, I really can't. And you know, when you think about the swan song that Eric Cantor gave and the response that came from Steny Hoyer, there wasn't much talk of bipartisanship. There was talk of honoring one's service, but not about the ability of people to get together.
You know, in that famous day when Michael and Foley were leaving, I don't want to belabor this too much, but Foley called Michael up to the Speaker's chair to oversee the House. I mean, it was just temporarily, and it was the first time a Republican has sat there in 40 years. But obviously, it was a Foley's tribute to Michael, as Michael was doing a tribute to Foley. That was a pretty amazing sight.
Well, it was, and I think it was a tribute to Bob Michael and his leadership. Even though he was never a member of the majority party, he provided the kind of leadership that allowed for good legislation, important legislation, bipartisan legislation, to pass, whether it was to help President Reagan or whether it was to help pass NAFTA under President Bill Clinton. Bob Michael was at the forefront of that. And did it in a way that really distinguished the institution and distinguished the members of Congress for the work that they did.
I don't want to sound like we're talking in the past tense. I should point out that Bob Michael is still very much with us. He's 91 years old. He's sharp as ever. In fact, we had him on the Political Junkie not that long ago after Tom Foley died. But what about style? I mean, you came to Congress the year Gingrich and the Republicans won control of the House and Gingrich became Speaker. Compare how Gingrich ran the House Republican Conference to how Bob Michael did it.
Well, he ran it. He gave the chairman of the committees the ability in the beginning to write their own bills. The first 100 days of the Gingrich era, the first 100 days of the Gingrich speakership, were all about the contract with America. Once those 10 bills passed, then we moved on to really trying to forge the kind of opportunities with President Clinton. And, you know, frankly, Ken, what happened was, I think in spite of two very strong-willed people, Gingrich and Clinton, we passed welfare reform, even though President Clinton vetoed it twice. We finally got around to a compromise. We passed four balanced budgets. Gingrich had an agenda. It was a national agenda, and it was an agenda that really resonated with people. And I think President Clinton realized that he had to be willing to work with Gingrich because the American people wanted to get things done.
Michael was in Congress for 38 years, and he was, as you say, he was never part of the majority. Did he talk much about that? Did he have regrets, those kind of regrets?
Very much so. I mean, I think when you're a member of the Congress and you never get to chair a committee, never get to chair a subcommittee, never get your name on a bill, never really get to carry the debate or lead the debate in the House, it does become very frustrating. I think he found it exhilarating being the leader with President Reagan because President Reagan was such a strong leader. And again, when President Clinton was in office, the Congress passed NAFTA, which was a very, very controversial trade agreement and passed in a bipartisan way. And Bob Michael was able to walk across the aisle and get some Democrats to vote for it. So even some of President Clinton's party, he was able to persuade.
The Republican Party is likely to keep control of the House this year. You know, they may even add a couple of seats, but they haven't had the same success recently in presidential elections. How come?
Well, because I think they have not been able to reach out to the and really touch the people with some of the important issues that need to be dealt with. The fact that the Republican Party is not able to pass immigration reform in the House. It did pass in the Senate, and it passed in a bipartisan way. And if Speaker Boehner had allowed Democrats to vote for an immigration bill with Republicans, it probably would have passed. Tax reform has been languishing now, a lot of frustration. The infrastructure bill, a transportation bill, languishing now, been extended into May with no certainty on when it will be passed. So these issues were always dealt with in a bipartisan way. Transportation was always bipartisan. Solving our immigration problems, always bipartisan. Tax reform, when Dan Rostenkowski was chairman, Reagan was in the White House, and Democrats were in control. Rostenkowski reached across the aisle, worked with President Reagan, and passed tax reform. And I think the fact that this Republican Congress cannot pass these and deal with these national issues has hurt the party nationally in terms of their ability to win the White House. And I think it will continue to hurt them if they don't come to grips with the idea they need Democrats to pass this legislation.
Ray LaHood was Bob Michael's longtime chief of staff. He succeeded him in Congress in 1995, served 14 years, and then went on to become President Obama's transportation secretary. Congressman, thanks so much for being on the show.
Thank you.
It was on this week in 1993 that Bob Michael announced his retirement, a decision that would change the course and identity of the Republican Party in Congress.
And I just want to say to all the members on both sides of the aisle how much I appreciate the camaraderie and the cordiality that I've enjoyed during my tenure in this body and all those wonderful good things that have happened to me this past year and your acknowledgement from time to time. It's overwhelming.
You're listening to This Week in Political History on The Political Junkie. I'm Ken Rudin in Washington. Capitol Hill is pretty desolate these days. Members of Congress are back home campaigning for another term. But something must be going on in Washington. We thought we'd check in with Catalina Camilla, political reporter for USA Today and the anchor of USA Today's On Politics blog. Catalina, welcome to the show.
Thanks, Ken. How are you today?
Good. Well, I mean, you and I are the only ones left in Washington. Everybody's out campaigning or they fled the city, but it's still just a month to go before the midterm elections. It's one of those times, I guess, when nobody could say for sure what's going to happen, especially in the battle for control of the Senate. What races are you looking at? What surprised you? What's captured your attention?
Well, there are a handful of Senate races that are very close at the moment and can go either way in determining which party controls the Senate. Today, USA Today and Suffolk University released a poll showing just how tight the race is in Kansas, both for the Senate and for governor. In the Senate race, independent Greg Orman has a lead over Pat Roberts, who finds himself in trouble after three terms. So you've got the Kansas race that we're all watching. We're watching Democratic incumbents in Arkansas, Alaska, and Louisiana. There is the belief that Senator Landrieu will go into a runoff, probably with Republican Bill Cassidy, in December. And that may actually tell us which party is in charge. But really what's at stake in the midterms is the last 2 years of President Obama's term. The tone and tenor of this election and who wins and who controls Congress will really decide what President Obama can do for the rest of his term.
I heard reports that if the Republicans win control of the Senate next month, there might be a lot of gridlock in Washington the next 2 years.
Would that be so unusual?
I'm saying that
from prior years.
Yeah, you can't see me on radio, but it's I'm suppressing a smile here.
Well, there are lots of things to be done even before the 113th Congress adjourns for the year. As you know, we will come back in a lame duck session after the elections, and we've got budget issues to discuss. We may be discussing the use of force in Syria and Iraq. There are always budget issues, fiscal issues, and the next year, early next year, I believe we have another debt ceiling vote to take up.
Well, one thing also that's perhaps on the calendar, on the schedule, is finding a replacement for Attorney General Eric Holder. It's still unsure when President Obama will name a successor and when confirmation hearings might be held. So let me ask you about both. One, who's on the short list? And two, when do you think, I mean, the Republicans obviously would love to push it off into 2015 when ostensibly they may have a majority in the Senate. What's the word on that?
Let me answer first the question about timing. Some Democrats, like Judiciary Chairman Pat Leahy, are calling for quick hearings, saying it would be irresponsible to delay them for political reasons. Now, President Obama has not yet named his choice to replace Eric Holder. We're concentrating on a couple of things. The big picture is there's the belief that the president wants someone who has his ear and his trust. And you look at people whose names have been mentioned, like Catherine Rumler, the former White House counsel, Donald Verrilli, the current Solicitor General, and they fit that bill. There are also names like Massachusetts Governor Deval Patrick, very close friend of President Obama, and California Attorney General Kamala Harris. Now, Ms. Harris is up for re-election in California. She has said she likes the job that she's doing now. Governor Patrick, who is not up for re-election in November, has said it's a great, big, interesting job, but it's not right for him at this time.
Right. He's retiring. He's retiring this year.
Yes. And then you've got a couple of U.S. attorneys whose names have come up. Preet Bharara in New York, who has been winning raves for his office's prosecution of Wall Street. Loretta Lynch in Brooklyn. But it comes back to who can get confirmed in the Senate and how much political capital the president wants to expend on this nomination. Right now, with the Democrats in control, it will only take 51 votes to confirm the next attorney general. If Republicans take control of the Senate, you may see them try to undo the so-called nuclear option and go back to a 60-vote threshold.
If you go back to 2006 and 2008, those were clearly Democratic waves that really seemed to break kind of late. In 2010, there was a Republican wave that also broke fairly late. You have a little over a month, maybe 5 weeks to go before the election. Do you see any kind of a similar wave, one way or the other, for 2014?
Well, polling, of course, suggests that it may not be a very good year for Democrats, and that's putting it mildly. I think we have to look at questions like the right, the direction of the country, where people feel they're headed, whether it's the right track or the wrong track. President Obama, in some of his speeches for the DNC and other Democratic groups, he's been making the case, potent question, are you better off now than you were before? And his argument is that you are better off with a Democratic Senate and, of course, a Democratic president. I think there are a handful of states where if things start to break for the Republican candidate, like in New Hampshire, where Scott Brown is running against Gene Shaheen, that may tell you a little bit more about whether this is a wave election like we saw in 2006 when the Democrats won control of the House.
What does your gut tell you about who controls the Senate after November 4th?
I think it's close, and I actually think that we may not know until Louisiana. You know, and the reporter in me likes the better story, and a tied or a close Senate, you have to admit, is a better story than one where there is a +5 advantage either way.
Catalina Camilla is a political reporter for USA Today. She can be found on Twitter at CCAMIA. Catalina, it was great having you on The Political Junkie.
Thanks, Ken.
One of the more interesting characters you'd find on C-SPAN passed away last week. James Traficant died after being injured in an accident on his daughter's farm. Anyone who has ever turned on the TV to watch Congress in action, and I say that somewhat ironically, no doubt remember this kind of rant from the former Ohio Democratic lawmaker.
Think about it. After our taxpayers are hit with unnecessary tax bills, heavy enough to cause a hernia for the Jolly Green Giant, they're told, if you don't like it, sue us. This isn't hearsay. This isn't rumor. This is an exact quote of an IRS agent who also said, beware, Congress, the IRS will tell you these are isolated incidents. That's not true. This is, in fact, standard policy. Beam me up. I say it's time for Congress to shove these illegal tactics right up the assets of the IRS.
You know, we were never quite sure what Traficant would say when he came to the House floor, but it was often outrageous, sometimes humorous, sometimes seemingly nuts. But he touched a chord with his Youngstown constituency, which sent him to Congress 9 times, until 2002, when he was expelled from the House after being convicted on federal corruption charges. Paul Sarasik is a professor of political science at Youngstown State University and is an expert on all things Traficant.
I don't know about that.
Paul, welcome to The Political Junkie.
Great to be here.
Explain the hold Traficant had with the voters of Youngstown.
Well, you know, one of the most common ways Jim Traficant was referred to around here was our Jimmy. And that kind of says a lot. I mean, he emerged from this community. And in many ways, I think a lot of people here thought he spoke for this community. And, you know, for their sense of the world. I mean, to understand, you know, this area, you have to go back into the late 1970s when the steel mills closed here. And thousands and thousands, tens of thousands of people eventually lost their job. And their perspective was that kind of the outside world, which doesn't make any sense, did something tremendously unfair to them. And it starts this kind of us against the world mentality here. And Jim Traficant was the perfect spokesman for that point of view.
And when he started out, I think he started out as a county sheriff, but whenever he ran for office, he always stood up for the little guy.
Well, right. Even as a county sheriff, I mean, he first makes his name when he refuses to follow through on foreclosure orders and has to go to jail for a number of days because as sheriff, he wasn't executing the foreclosures. From the start of his career, he has sort of this populist background. And I've always thought it's a little bit of a contradiction because, you know, when he gets out of prison, one of the first things he does is speak essentially at a Tea Party rally. And there's a lot of people that'll tell you that Jim Traficant was Tea Party before there was a Tea Party. You know, a lot of those sort of anti, you know, big government themes. But you think how ironic that is, because the Tea Party starts with, you know, the rant from Rick Santilli which was against mortgage modifications. So there's contradictions all through, you know, what Traficant would do and say.
Well, one of the things everybody knew about him, even in the years before he ran for Congress, I mean, he was always accused of being in cahoots with mobsters or up to some kind of nefarious scheme. In fact, he was indicted for taking bribes in 1982 before he ran for Congress, and yet he was acquitted. So he was some kind of a hero against the establishment.
Sure. I mean, and the acquittal is really kind of stunning because he'd actually signed a confession. And you know, he represented himself before the federal government. I mean, everyone knows that the federal government wins most of the time in court, an incredible number of times. And to have someone who wasn't an attorney even, you know, representing himself and beating the big guys, I mean, it's really almost a David versus Goliath story that you know, he shouldn't have won that. And it, you know, it really makes him, along with his actions, you know, as a sheriff not foreclosing, you know, a local hero. And you know, the trials in 1983, in 1984, he turns around and runs and gets elected to Congress.
And the voters loved him, right?
Yes. You know, he barely had to campaign. I still remember his very small sort of green and white, you know, Traficant for Congress signs that would appear every 2 years. The same sign to just recycle them. He didn't really have to run. You know, he was so well known here and really loved it. And it wasn't just, you know, the 1 minute speeches. It was also, you know, people felt here that he cared about them. You know, Traficant was one of the first people to sort of rail against, you know, immigration and talk about securing our southern border. But, you know, I'll tell you, the first time I ever met Jim Traficant, I was actually at a Chinese New Year celebration with a local Chinese American community who had embraced Traficant because he had been so helpful to them in working out some immigration problems over the time. So there's all these contradictions. You know, he's this big, almost sort of dangerous guy. But at the same time, he clearly cared for his constituents and did his, you know, casework, as we say. He took care of the local people.
You mentioned those one-minute speeches on the House floor. Okay, this is radio. Help explain what we saw when we turned on C-SPAN and saw a Traficant on the House floor.
Right. Well, you know, first you have to realize he was huge. I mean, he was a big guy, a former high school football star who had been a star in college, University of Pittsburgh, had a tryout with the Pittsburgh Steelers. He was a big guy. He had, you know, it turned out it was a wig, but he had, you know, big hair that he said, you know, he used to trim with a weed whacker, and that's what it looked like, or sort of outrageous suits or sweater vest or, you know, something. He was not a fashion plate, but just the opposite.
He wore bell. Didn't he wear bell bottoms or something?
Bell bottoms, denims. You know, you name it. It clearly, he was different. He stood out, even if you had never heard of him before. If you saw that speech, you know, he's very animated. You know, waving his hands, you couldn't miss him. So it was a performance. I mean, he really was, you know, performing the role of the populist leader.
And this was a pretty much a Democratic district, but he was not your regular kind of Democrat. He was anti-abortion, and I remember once he voted for Dennis Hastert, a Republican, for Speaker against his own Democratic candidate for Speaker. So he was not always in lockstep with his party.
No. I mean, he didn't like, you know, Dick Gephardt. I mean, even after he gets convicted, he has not kind words for Representative Gephardt. But yeah, he votes for Denny Hastert. And, you know, the funny thing is, you know, I teach, you know, government classes here, and there's so many things you can illustrate with Jim Traficant. I mean, you teach about the Speaker of the House and how he's elected by the whole House, and usually it's a party line vote, except when you have Jim Traficant in there who crosses party lines. And there's even a story here about that, because a few months after he did that, 20-some million dollars showed up in Youngstown to build a convocation center, a community center that no one had ever asked for. And it was in an emergency funding bill for Kosovo. So, you know, even with that, even though he got kicked off of committees after that, people kind of gave him credit for it, saying, I see, you know, he was smart. Look what we got in return. He knows how to work the system. So, you know, even that, he turned into a positive.
What ultimately ended his career? Talk a little bit about the indictment in 2001.
Right, he gets convicted on a 10-count federal indictment that there were a lot of different elements to it, including having, you know, the farm that he actually had the accident on. He would have he was convicted of having some of his, you know, congressional aides do work during work hours, you know, on that farm, of having local contractors do work essentially for free to build up the farm. He was convicted of taking about, I think, a $40,000 bribe from a local businessman here in turn for doing, you know, some favors. You know, but honestly, I showed up at that trial for a few days to watch what was going on. And, you know, he defended himself again, as he had done in 1983. And, you know, to most people that know anything about the law, it was kind of a huge mistake. Here he is, a member of Congress, and this is kind of inside baseball, but there's something, you know, the speech and debate clause, which immunizes members of Congress oftentimes from being questioned. about what they did on the floor of Congress, what they said. Had he had an attorney, I'm pretty sure that he would have made sure that Trafficant hadn't essentially waived that immunity. But he does by calling some testimony in sort of about that, so he doesn't have that kind of standard protection that a member of Congress would have. And it probably results, maybe he would not have been acquitted on all the charges, but, you know, as it's turned out, he was convicted on all the charges. Even after that, you know, he still, you know, runs to get elected, but once he goes to prison, he attempts to run from prison. I think the Congressional Research Service had to do a study to find out whether you could actually be elected from prison because of the requirement that you reside in the state.
Before you get to the part where he goes to prison, as you say, he famously defended himself on the House floor. Let's give it a listen.
Now, you go ahead and expel me, but you ran this place for 50 years, Democrats. And you made the IRS, the FBI, and Justice Department so strong, our people are afraid to death of them. I'm ready to go to jail. I'll go to jail before I admit to a crime I didn't commit. And there was never any intent to commit a crime. And when they start bringing letters that you send to cabinet members trying to help your people, folks, there was a dangerous precedent set in U.S. versus Trafficant.
Right, but he tried, and he got some votes. I mean, he got about 30,000 votes in the area. And then when he got out of prison, he ran again.
So after he was convicted of the charges, the House voted 420-1 to expel him. The one, by the way, was Gary Condit, which is an interesting story, but we could do that, talk about that some other time. He became only the second member of the House to be expelled since the Civil War. What was the reaction in Youngstown?
I think there was a bad feeling about it. I mean, people didn't want to be known in this area as an area that had their member of Congress expelled, but there was still, you know, an underlying kind of support, sympathy for him. This was our Jimmy, and, you know, see, they're doing it to this area again. His rants were somewhat accepted in this area. It was thought that when it comes to politics, everybody does this. You know, you would hear that, and he just got caught, or they just decided to go after him. But at the same time, you know, I think the area and the evolution of the area was passing Jim Trafficant by. We talked about Still Mills before. Those are long gone. So, you know, that sort of generation is passing, and the whole area is changing a little bit. And I think that's reflected in, you know, the new congressman, Tim Ryan and Bill Johnson, a Republican and a Democrat.
Paul, if there's such a thing as a Trafficant legacy, what would it be?
I don't know. His very strong supporters will tell you that, you know, the law changing, the presumption of guilt when the IRS is involved, that was something that was sponsored by Trafficant and was passed. His concern with border security was, you know, maybe ahead of its time. But I think the reality is, you know, a lot of those things might have happened, you know, without him or, you know, despite him, because he really wasn't that good when it came down to it as sort of working through the normal channels of Congress, to make change. But, you know, certainly, you know, he's a personality. And, you know, his whole theme, beam me up at the end, I think is probably reflective of what a lot of people think about Washington, D.C., that it's sort of a foreign planet that isn't like the rest of the country. And when you hear the things that are said down there and argued about down there, that maybe a lot of Americans say, maybe, you know, beam me up, take me back to reality. That was, you know, Trafficant's message. And I think that still resonates, and he'll be long be remembered for that.
Paul Sarasik is the chair of the Political Science Department at Youngstown State University. He can be beamed up on Twitter at P.A. Sarasik. That's S-R-A-C-I-C. Paul, thanks so much for being on the program.
Thank you.
Before we go, a bunch of thanks to spread around. Thank you, my good friend Neil Conan, for hosting last week's show. I was sick and I had no voice, and you were a godsend. I know hosting a radio program may not be your strength, but I thought you did a pretty good job. And a big thank you to WXXI for having Neil and me and the team for the Political Junkie Roadshow last weekend in Rochester, New York. Thanks so much to WXXI President Norm Silverstein, News Director Randy Gorbin, Vice President for Radio Gene Fisher, crack political reporter Karen DeWitt, and the entire staff at WXXI, with a special shout-out to Kathy Reed and Corinne Dagan. A good time was had by all. Well, many. Some. And don't forget, another show is coming up Tuesday evening, October 7th, in Sacramento at the Assembly with Capital Public Radio's Beth Ruyek and me. Tickets are still available, but they're going fast. Go to Capital Public Radio's website for more, or go to, as always, krpoliticaljunkie.com. That's it for this week's show. Political Junkie is made possible by WAMU 88.5 here in Washington and PRX, the Public Radio Exchange. Want to catch the podcast? We're on iTunes, Stitcher, TuneIn Radio, and more. Subscribe at our website, krpoliticaljunkie.com. And while you're there, you can sign up for our newsletter, check out bonus junkie content, bad jokes, and scuttlebutt puzzles. You can find the Political Junkie on Facebook, too. We're the one with the button. On Twitter, we're at Ken Rudin and at Ken Rudin Junkie. And, drumroll please, the Political Junkie is on Instagram. You can follow us for behind-the-scenes looks at my button collection. The Button of the Day on Instagram. Search the Political Junkie, all one word. Hashtag awesome. Our producer and editor is A.D. Quigg. Douglas Bell is our coordinating producer and webmaster. Kristen Sorensen is our consultant. And Alex Drewinskis is our engineer. I'm Ken Rudin in Washington. Thanks for listening. See you next week.